Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
So I think this actually maps to some dynamics of the 18th century, where AOC is sort of an 1840s leader, right? So she is an example of a leader building the ferment, advocating for change, building the resistance. You know, resistance, you know, by its nature is non-governing. Whether it's left wing or right wing, I think of the ferment, the rage, you know, to come back to, you know, the title of my book, as being something that maps to the 1840s. And it was then after that period where you saw the emergence of the Bismarcks and the others who drew from that. But, you know, it wasn't like, you know, the anarchist labor leader who implemented these policies. You know, the anarchist labor leader may have advocated for X, and X minus 10 is actually what became codified into statute or regulation by leaders who do know how to forge consensus.
Quick programming note for everyone. Sagar and I are on the road this week, so this episode and the one after it are going to be just me. I've been thinking a lot about a 2-star review we got on Apple Podcasts, and just to really summarize, the reviewer pointed out that a lot of what Sagar and I thought about a political realignment, especially back in the first season, didn't really come to pass. A good way of thinking about our frame back in 2019, early pre-COVID 2020, and definitely the 2018 space when we were thinking about the show, was this idea that everything after 2016 came down to populism. And whether it was of the left or of the right, that was the central frame through thinking about politics. And in the reviewer's review, which you can check out on Apple Podcasts if you haven't done that yet, he just points out that that frame effectively wasn't correct. Therefore, he gets the sense that he or she gets the sense that the show is treading water because we don't exactly have a frame. I've really been obsessed with that pushback because it gets to something very useful, which is everyone, whether they're left, right, center, non-affiliated, Democrat or Republican, everyone basically gets this idea that we're all searching for a frame to understand our political moment right now, understand the United States, understand the world. And it's been very clear for the past season that Sagar and I have been listlessly trying to figure out how we should think about things. So a good way to think of the upcoming episodes is we are all trying to get at what that frame should be. If we're rejecting the frame of the first season, how can we work through the show and the interviews we have to help all of us think about these things a little better? So with that in mind, our guest today is Alec Ross. He is the author of The Raging 2020s, Companies, Countries, People, and the Fight for a Future. Alec is a former State Department official. He's a professor, and he's also the author of The Industries of the Future. I cannot recommend either of his books enough. This is the perfect way to kick off our focus on understanding our political moment because it's very timely in the sense that this book is about the 2020s. It's about how, if we're looking at the debates we're having right now, they basically come down to the fact that the social contract that we came up with during the founding of this country, during the 19th, early 20th century, is effectively breaking down. And most of our fights are going to come down to disagreements about how our society should look and how the various actors in our society should operate. And what's so useful about Alec's idea is that he frames everything around the fact that right now, it's not just about a government and citizens. It's not just about government and citizens, but it's also about companies. Now you have these three different actors who, in their various ways, are going to have to come to some type of accord, for good or for ill, to move forward. So this episode is really about social contracts, how they're formed, how politics operates. It's honestly one of my favorite episodes that we've done in a long time, just because I love having opportunities to try to think through what's going on here. Because to the reviewer's point, it's getting harder and harder to be confident about what we know. So any effort we can do to think deeply about this with a really excellent guest is a huge opportunity. So as I mentioned, Alec has two books. You could find them in our bookshop, help support the author, help support the show, help support independent booksellers. You can also go check out our Substack. I've started putting out original written content there. If you enjoy the writing on Smedley Butler and the military industrial complex, you enjoy my expanded thoughts on this episode as well too. Lots of great stuff. Of course, we couldn't do this without the work of the Lincoln Network, not Lincoln Project. We're going to keep pushing that to loon listeners for a few episodes. There's a lot here. Y'all are going to enjoy this. Let's get into the episode.
All right, giddy up.
Alec Ross, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start by talking about your book's real conception, which is the raging 2020s. I want you to explain what that means, because I was one of those people who, during the depths of COVID lockdown, was really looking forward to a roaring 2020s. Everyone really saw the hope. It's, you know, the Spanish flu, it's 1919, we're going to emerge into something greater, but you're putting forth this idea that we're going to emerge into something continuing more difficult. So we'd love for you just to explain the idea there.
Sure. So the raging has a dual connotation. I can either be rage, angry, life sucks, this pandemic is never going away, the economy screwed, you know, I hate my political opposite. Or it can be raging in the connotation that my 18-year-old son thinks of it, like a great party, sort of hearkening back to the roaring 20s. And I think it could be either. I think, you know, it's interesting. I think we're in a moment right now where we get to determine whether the end of this decade we are tilting toward Mad Max or tilting toward Star Trek, something more utopian or more dystopian. And it's really a set of choices that we have, I believe, really over the next 2 or 3 years to figure out what the trajectory of the decade is going to be. And so the raging 2020s does not say what's going to happen, but rather it lays out a series of choices in front of us about how we can set or not our trajectory.
To put you on the spot, and I could guess your answer, I'm personally leaning towards the more optimistic note, but which do the two, separate from your book, do you lean towards? Even just more dispositionally.
Optimism. Look, only optimists change the world. You know, I think that, you know, pessimists who are crying into their coffee every day and sort of fist balled up and saying that nothing works, nothing's going to work, and we are tilting toward dystopia, there's a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy there. And I do think, you know, I think of the words of Picasso, who said, every work of creation begins with an act of destruction. And I do think that as political destruction takes place, as the destruction brought on by COVID makes us rethink things, I think it does give us a tremendous opportunity to realign, to reset our trajectory. And, you know, we can think about, you know, Marshall, you hearkened back to the beginning of the 1920s, the end of World War I and the Spanish flu. There are many other precedents for this. You know, let's go back to the 1840s. You know, this was, you know, when Europe's economy was transitioning from being dominantly agricultural to industrial. Largest wave of revolutions in Europe's history. Ideological movements like communism. The Communist Manifesto was written in 1848. And then what happened? Bismarck and other great leaders emerged. And we sort of rewrote our social contract to make industrialization work. So I do tilt toward optimism.
There's so many interesting things here. Let's start with this one. You keep using the words we, which given the framework of your book is really interesting, because my key takeaway is that we can conceptualize society and these debates around companies, countries, and people. So what's interesting about your invocation of the word we here is that in many cases, a lot of these decisions are actually up to companies. And by definition, the people who are working at the companies and the people in the C-suite. There also are countries. Countries have different systems. China with the CCP is a closed version of that system. We'll get into this later. The U.S. is a very open system. So speak about how we should conceptualize the word we, because depending on how we're looking at these topics, we has entirely different meanings.
No, there's no question. I'm in violent agreement with everything you just said. So we can think about this at the individual level. You know, what are the things that I can do within my family, within my sort of network of friends and fellow travelers to reset the trajectory? But, and you make a very important point here, the difference between now and just about any other time in history is the fact that we do live in a world where companies are as powerful as countries. If for 99% of the world's history, companies have been subsidiary to their sovereign nation state, I think we're in sort of the other 1% right now, where as much power is exerted in the C-suite and in the boardrooms of the world's most powerful companies as is exerted inside the prime minister's office of most countries. And in fact, you know, if we're going to be honest about it, Tim Cook, Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, you know, they have a lot more power than just about any prime minister of a European country, more power than the president of Mexico. And the decisions they make, interestingly, are incredibly consequential on things like minimum wage. The minimum wage goes up not when the United States government raises it, but when Walmart and Target raised it. Sustainability. You know, we're in a situation right now where the U.S. government actually does very little on sustainability. And when big companies decide to do something on sustainability, it has a bigger impact. On issues of equity and other such things, it's oftentimes these big CEOs whose actions are more consequential than anything that happens in the United States Congress or federal government.
So two related questions to that. One would be, is this a bad thing?
So I think it's good and it's bad. I mean, first of all, let's be clear, there's no democratic consent, right? Like, so when Jeff Bezos decides to do something and it has this huge spillover effect into markets, into all of our communities, there's no democratic consent. I don't always think that that's necessarily a bad thing, though. So in many respects, our democracy is growing weaker and we've become, in certain respects, more of a corporate autocracy. But a lot of these companies are more agile and more capable of delivering on change than our governments. I mean, that's the God's honest truth. It's not how I would want it to be in theory, but in reality, it's proving true. And look, as you know, this is not black hat, white hat, you know, good guys, bad guys. You know, this is a world of shades of gray, where sometimes it has positive effects and other times it has malignant effects.
That's really interesting. In theory, then, how would you want this to look?
In theory, what I would like is for governments to play the role leading, setting environmental standards that can give guidance to the market, setting labor standards and labor laws that allow for broader participation in, you know, the spoils of market-based capitalism. In theory, I would like for the government to lead on tax. You know, a lot of what I write about in the book is, you know, the degree to which our global tax system, understanding our global tax system, which is incredibly boring, but incredibly important, it's sort of a skeleton key for unlocking a lot of the equity that we hope for in the government. So in theory, Marshall, what I'd love is for government to lead on all of these things. But absent their leadership, you know, one approach is to say, oh, government's not doing anything. The other, though, is for our CEOs to say, you know what, we see a problem here. It's beginning to affect our bottom line. It's affecting the well-being of our suppliers and breaking our supply chains. So absent that leadership from government, I'm encouraging of the private sector to lead.
What I really appreciate about the book is you approach this power that corporations exert just as a given. It's a reality of the society we live in, and one can bemoan it, as you just did to a certain degree, but moving forward, as you're calculating these next 2 or 3 years, you have to operate within that context. But I want to try to have a semi-sophisticated discussion right now of why government can't do things, because what I get frustrated by is if we were to do a typical version of this conversation, we would be
traditionally center-left mainstream institutions say things like, hey, like, it really is terrible that government won't lead on climate change. It's really terrible that government won't do healthcare, energy, basically any topic. But from my perspective, having recently vacated DC, but having spent 6 years there, the clear reason why government doesn't lead is because there's no actual consensus within our democracy around these issues. So from my perspective, bemoaning the power of these companies would be one thing if America actually was 70-30 in favor of the Green New Deal, or there actually was 70-30 in favor of universal healthcare, or pick your policy position. But the defining reality of this moment from my perspective is the fact that there is no actual consensus. Therefore, what leads corporations to take the role they're taking is that either by the fact that C-suites are homogeneous, I don't just mean at the gender or racial level, but I just mean, frankly, like class background, educational background, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So Jeff Bezos and the team, Tim Cook and the team, are actually probably aligned. Therefore, there's an actual consensus and you can move forward. So I'm just curious how you think about this framework from your perspective.
It'd be fun if I disagreed with you. I'd love to fight with you about this, but I actually agree.
That's why I booked you.
There's a system. So look, you know, in this crazy book, I say there are three things, and you focused in on one thing. There are three things that I really think are keeping government from making progress. And the third one I'll give flows into the point you were making. Number one, kludgeocracy. Okay, kludgeocracy is a theory put forward by a Johns Hopkins political scientist named Stephen Pellis. And what it basically means is that the actual operations of government have grown so complicated and so regulated that we can't do things that we did 100 years ago. 100 years ago, we built subways. We built bridges. 70 years ago, we built a national highway system. Imagine trying to do that right now. It would take like $1 quadrillion in a quadrillion years. It's because it's gotten kludgy. Kludge is a software patch. It's sort of a patch that you put on buggy software code to make it work. And in many respects, the actual functioning of government has grown so kludgy, we can't do big projects anymore. That's thing one. Thing two, brain drain. Now, there are very many capable people in government, but unfortunately, unlike the Cold War years when, you know, if you were one of the best and brightest and graduated from a really good college or university, and you're an econ major, it was elite to go to work for the Treasury Department. If you were graduated in the humanities, it was elite to go work at the State Department or at the CIA. Going to work for state and local government was viewed as, you know, there's prestige here. From about the mid to late 90s on, that flipped. I went in to Teach for America. Others go into McKinsey or Goldman Sachs. And so we've lost a lot of the intellectual firepower in government. And even when we do capture it, it tends to be political appointees for 3, 4, 5 years. And even our civil servants, they get to a certain point and they realize, hey, I can double my salary and work less by going to work in the private sector. That's number two. And then number three is what you pointed to, what Francis Fukuyama calls vetocracy. We are such a deeply divided country right now. You're right. If we were 70-30 on any of this, it'd get done. We aren't 70-30 on just about any of this. So again, to invoke history for a moment, there was a post-World War consensus around 80, maybe 85% of what we governed around. We could never do a 1986 tax act where Dan Rostenkowski and Tip O'Neill work with Ronald Reagan and forge a far-reaching tax deal. That would never happen today. And what they did is they found the ground to find that 70%. Mm-hmm. The absence of that is why government has ground to a halt. The very idea of a presidential mandate doesn't exist right now. I mean, it was forever and a day where, you know, for the first 200 days of a given administration, the party in opposition, even if they controlled the House or the Senate, it was accepted. You would stand down and allow the incoming administration to govern. It was part of the governing culture of government. Ronald Reagan did not control the United States Congress. We had divided government for decades preceding. But there was a perception of a mandate that came with election to the presidency. It doesn't exist right now. And so we do have exactly what you described.
So to push back against your and my priors and serve as an audience advocate, There's a fourth issue that we didn't mention, which many listeners have just brought up in terms of pushback to the way I think about these things. What about corruption? Right? So you could say, and I, once again, like, I disagree with it, but I'm trying to play devil's advocate here.
Sure.
A lot of people say the reason why we don't accomplish the things we want is because we live in an increasingly corrupt political system. This is why you have increasing distaste with the two-party system. This is why you have this general post-Watergate history of declining faith in institutions. Talk about, let's just say, capture corruption and how that plays into this whole idea of not being able to implement, quote unquote, what the people want.
So I think we need to split the concept of corruption into two pieces, all right? If by corruption you mean illegal behavior. You know, I worked in government for, I saw nothing. Like, I just got to be honest. Like, there was little to no, like, cash and carry corruption. There was no wink, wink. Hey, if you give this grant to this organization or introduce this clause in this bill, I'm going to pay you back on the other side with you when you leave government. That doesn't really exist as far as I saw. And, you know, look, I reported directly to Secretary of State. I spent a lot of time in the White House Situation Room and seeing how policy actually plays out, oftentimes on really high stakes economic issues. And what I saw was a pretty clean playing field from a defining corrupt as, you know, illegal behavior.
Pay for play those bits.
Yeah. If you're defining corruption as we get the government that we paid for, I think that that is a more valid critique. You know, I think the data is something like 86% of people elected to the United States Congress, you know, spent more than their opposition. So I think that to the extent that you are going to sort of tag corruption into government, first of all, you need to segregate to the legislative branch. So there's the executive branch, the judicial branch, and the legislative branch. If any branch of government is captured by money, it is the legislative branch. But I'll say this, now that small dollar fundraising is so grows in power and importance, people can take more extreme views that cut across, let's call it the Chamber of Commerce consensus, and they can raise lots of money in smaller units. So like Josh Hawley from Missouri, you know, when he sort of championed the January 6th insurrection, you might have said, well, you know, that's really against his interest because sort of the country club Republicans who historically pay for Senate candidacies, you know, he just lost them. But what Hawley also got was the ability to do massive grassroots fundraising. So I do think that small dollar fundraising has diminished the power and importance of bundlers.
I think that is such a helpful point. We're going to keep on agreeing with each other because several things on the corruption note. So one, the funny thing about the conversation around corruption, and I like the way you delineated it, is these eras in American history that we look at with, wow, we can do this and we can do that, they were incredibly corrupt. Pre-Watergate America, when it comes to unlimited campaign donations, when it comes to lobbyist controls, lack of transparency, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that system was actually far more corrupt. So it seems hard to look at the current logjam today and attribute that to corruption, because corruption doesn't necessarily have to lead to bad outcomes. It feels like if you actually talk to one of the people who are making the corruption point, they actually, weirdly enough, would be very satisfied with the set of things that were going on in the 40s and 50s in certain areas. But secondly, to your point too, and I'm glad you brought up the Chamber of Commerce, if our system was corrupt in the sense that people colloquially refer to corruption, the Chamber of Commerce would be achieving much more of its political objectives. Because that's the funny thing about this, which is that if you actually look at the political objectives of the quote-unquote lobbies, they actually aren't really being met. So I think that's a fascinating thing. I want to go to something you said about the brain drain part, because you referenced the fact that you were in the Obama administration. And I'm just a little skeptical of the brain drain argument in the sense that, look, you know, I showed up in DC in 2010, so I remember, even as a wide-eyed freshman in college, what that space looked like, which is, it was really cool to go to DC. You had the whole Silicon Valley crew showing up. Christina Hendricks from Mad Men is dating Jon Favreau, Obama's speechwriter. There actually was a moment where DC was very sexy and very cool. So you really, if you were just purely to look at everyone's credentials, this, this, and that, it was markedly impressive in a way that I think you could argue that mid-2008 oh, Washington wasn't. But that didn't seem to actually result in a difference. So I guess what I'm putting forward is this idea of I'm really struggling to see a set of policy problems that you and people like you are confronting in DC that isn't being solved at a pure brain power level, right? So what I'm basically saying is I don't really see a set of policy issues where, man, if we just bumped people up from C-list state school grads to top tier, could have gone to McKinsey, could have won a Rhodes Scholarship grads, I don't see an issue which would have been markedly improved, but like push back if you disagree on that.
Yeah, so let me give you an example or two where I think that isn't the case. If you look at emerging technologies, you know, AI, for example, the Chinese government, the sophistication coming out of the Chinese government on AI, you know, setting a national strategy, you know, understanding the impact of artificial intelligence, machine learning and robotics in the economy is, I would argue, far greater in the Chinese government than it is in the United States government. And unfortunately, I do think that particularly on technology issues, where so much of the expertise lives outside of government, I do think that that is particularly harmful. Now, there are always some good people, like there's some good people in the Biden administration right now who understand these things. But the fact that I can name them is a problem. There isn't a class of civil servant. There aren't 200 and 300 and 400 people who, if they weren't working in government, they could get jobs at Microsoft, right? You know, working on these set of issues. So I think that on technology policy issues, which are increasingly important, that's been a problem. If I were to think of a second one, I would say it's the future of work, labor issues. And let me be critical of the Obama administration for a second. So from 2009 through 2017, those 8 years where he was president, the nature of work changed substantially. We were coming out of the economic crisis. The America's working and middle classes were stagnating economically. I would argue that the labor policies of the Obama administration were sort of warmed over Truman policies. And in fact, there was very little foresight and understanding about the future of work and the changing nature of work and how that in turn should impact labor policies. And by contrast, I think like you can find a lot of expertise about this in the private sector.
And can you clarify something real quick? What do you mean by Truman era policies?
What I mean by is the idea of a pension is you work for a single employer for 30 years and you get a pension at the end of those 30 years. Marshall, in your generation, how many of your peers are going to have one employer for 30 years? And at the end of those 30 years, you're going to get a pension. It's like a concept from Mars, right?
Yeah.
So when I talk about Truman era policies, I think about, okay, how do we develop labor policies that reflect the changing nature of work and labor in the 2020s and beyond? And I would argue that the Obama administration, when it wanted to talk to labor, it would go to the AFL-CIO and these other unions whose views really haven't changed since the Truman administration, who are advocating for the exact same things. We have to have employer-based collective action, blah, 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 you know, with it. It's the same stuff. But the nature of work changed substantially in that time. And so this is one area where I'd be critical of the Obama administration. I hope the Biden administration is better. We'll see. But the nature of work, the nature of labor is changing. It's going from being increasingly employer-based to project-based, curated over platforms. We're seeing people your age coming out of, having more like 10 employers in 25 years than one or two employers in 25 years. This has far-reaching consequences. We need to think about detethering our benefits from being employer-based. We need to think increasingly about portable benefits and things like this. So this is what I mean when I talk about labor policies for the 2020s and beyond.
I'm asking this on two levels. How would you assess the Trump administration? In the sense that let's start on the narrative level, right? So the narrative level is, and once again, let's put aside Trump personally, let's just focus purely on the 2015-2016 rhetoric, which is political class, abandoned, rust belt, legacy America, and advanced a pro-globalization agenda, TPP, letting China into the World Trade Organization, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that focus led to leaving millions of Americans behind because we assumed that choices that were seemingly inevitable weren't actually inevitable. So can you respond to the Trump narrative in 2016 from a labor perspective, and then also a performance of how that idea, quote unquote, was implemented over the 4 years?
Sure. So, and, you know, I should give some context here. I'm a public school kid from West Virginia. You know, I worked on a beer truck and as a midnight janitor to help put myself through college. So I come from the white hot center of Trumpism. My parents, you know, I visited them last month. They're still in West Virginia. And West Virginia went from sort of union Democrat. So think of it as sort of politically liberal, economically conservative, party line voters for Democrats. I mean, they voted for Michael Dukakis in 1988 and then became, you know, I think maybe second only to Oklahoma in terms of the level of support for Trump in his presidential elections. So that by way of context.
Yeah.
So what I would say is that Trump's rhetoric, his narrative, perfectly matched those communities where there was this emasculation. You know, there was the, you know, this sense that, you know, the America where once I would have sat at the head of the dinner table at 6 o'clock and I would have watched the 6:30 news and I then would have gone bowling at 7 o'clock and I had a place of primacy in the world, that evaporated, as you know, over a period of decades. And what Trump then engaged in political theory, it's called palingenesis. It's the evocation of a utopian past that may or may not have existed before. And there's plenty of precedent for it. You know, Mussolini said, Rome will rise again. Hitler rose in substantial part because of he was responding to the emasculation of the German state post-World War I and evoked the greatness of Germany's past. And so when Trump would say, we're going to make America great again, we're going to open the coal mines, he's evoking this ideal of the 1950s. Now, the problem, to go from the narrative to the performative, is he put the hard hat on in southern West Virginia, not far from where my parents live, and goes, we're going to open up these coal mines. They didn't open. That's the thing. You know, he would condemn the trade deals, condemn the Chinese, say we're going to, it didn't actually happen. Because you can't sort of click your heels together like Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz and say, there's no time like 1955. It doesn't work that way. And so there was a very substantial difference between his rhetoric and what the actual policies were. You know, if you look at sort of the Steve Mnuchin Treasury policies, in many respects, it made globalizing capital easier. You know, there were none of the trends in globalization actually dialed down, but for some of the imports and exports that were within the gun sights of the Trump era tariffs. So this is a case, Marshall, where there is a very, very, very hard difference between the Trump narrative and what the actual Trump policies were. You know, it's interesting, just one final point on this to come back to taxes. It's always interesting to me to go back to West Virginia and talk to folks who talk about taxes. And I just look at them and they talk about their tax cuts. And if we're at a bar and if people got a few beers in their belly, then, you know, you can go a little and be like, now, what's your household? Now, are you middle class? How much money do you make? You got one of these Trump tax cuts. And I'd be like, I made $52,000 last year. I'd be like, buddy, you didn't get a tax cut. I did. And so this was also a big difference. He had this rhetoric for appearing to perform on behalf of these people, when in fact he was performing on behalf of the Upper East Side of Manhattan. He was delivering tax cuts to his peers and his near peers, as opposed to the people whose votes he was harvesting.
I want to go to your reference to emasculated, because it brings to mind a recent Wall Street Journal piece that made a lot of waves talking about how there's been a significant decline in male attendance at institutions of higher education. And you're increasingly seeing a sex imbalance in those contexts. So there seems to be internet debates about incels aside, there really does seem to be some type of gender-based bifurcation going on that goes into your emasculation point. What do you think is going on here at a societal level?
This is fascinating. And this is one of these cases, I've been talking about West Virginia, but I now live in Baltimore. And I see this as much in inner city Baltimore as I do in rural West Virginia. And in a certain respect, these communities could not be more different. And yet the dynamic that you are describing is the same. I wish I knew exactly what was happening, but what I can simply do is validate that it is in fact happening. You know, what we see is this sort of ennui setting in. Let's go back to the 1920s. We saw a little bit of this in the 1920s, but it oftentimes was with veterans. We would see young men sort of becoming driftless and, you know, drifting, rootless. You know, this created the sort of the flaneurs, you know, sort of walking through cities, you know, doing day labor as much as they needed to eat. We're seeing more of that now, but unfortunately, we're all seeing it with opioids attached. You know, we are seeing it with other byproducts, and we see the women emerging in rural West Virginia, in inner city Baltimore, to sort of take their places. And I wish I knew exactly what was happening. I will say the one community that I can identify most closely within this is sort of the sort of rural working class, because that's sort of where I come from. And I do think this sense that, you know, we are on top of the world, you know, we are the ones who won the Cold War and are taking on the Russians. You know, we, you know, I'm white male and American. This means that I'm the most powerful person in the world. That isn't really true anymore. It's only true if you're wealthy. And so I think the loss of that has created a sort of existential problem for the working class white male in America. And even on social media, it's interesting for me to see the trolls, my trolls, the people who get their blood up. It's like, I swear to God, it is 90, 95% of the time. It's a white dude between 35 and 65. And, you know, if you're curious, click, see his LinkedIn profile, and it's a little bit of a mess. You know, it's, oh, you're a consultant for this. Okay. So this emasculation is something real, and it lends itself to being disaffected with society, and it lends itself to becoming politically radicalized.
I think it's such a fascinating conversation because it's the perfect example of an issue that we can't come to a consensus on, because during this specific period in American history and world history even, we're stuck between two zones. So at an elite institutional level, we're deeply aware of the fact that we're coming out of this post-60s era where huge gender-based discrimination issues, Title IX, boardroom representation, this goes to the discussion around how companies and corporations are changing. But at the same time, looking into the 2020s, we're actually seeing we have a society where it seems on the face of it, once again, putting aside the Me Too movement and all like the real legitimate work that's being done here, we don't quite have language to address and conceptualize this, which is why, once again, I'll put forth, we can't actually come to a consensus on it. I want to raise something else up because I think it will be interesting to folks. Could you speak to what the narrative of this country should be, especially given the context of your previous book too, Industry of the Future? Because one frustration I have with center-left to liberal people who dunk on the Trumpian rhetoric is, yes, obviously the 1950s were not literally like that. Yes, insert statement about how you're looking at some idealized past, but I think at a political level, what those critiques miss is that that's what politics is. Politics is about storytelling. And if you look at FDR and New Deal America, that was also not accurate. Plenty of things, you know, ask a black person in the South whether or not FDR was actually offering you a fair deal. So, you know, once again, I think we should move past for a second the obvious flaws of the Trumpian narrative and just realize that at a certain point, there actually was a successful narrative. And if you're looking at past Joe Biden, where I see Democrats really struggling, it doesn't seem like there is a successful narrative. I don't think that narrative is socialism. I don't think that narrative is necessarily embodied by anyone who's moving forward. So what do you think the mythos of our country should be.
So I benefit a little bit from the perspective of having lived abroad. You know, even this past year, I lived in Italy for the past year, and of the 196 countries on planet Earth, I've traveled to more than 100 of them. And so it's been fascinating for me to be able to hear the outsider's perspective of America's greatness. And that then has informed my answer to this question. It's one of work hard, play by the rules, and you can become anybody and do anything. You know, ours is the country of meritocracy in its idealized form. What should our narrative be? Our narrative should be rooted to things like 40% of the Fortune 500 were founded by immigrants or the children of immigrants. You know, why do people go from these gorgeous European cities and, you know, a beautiful city in Italy and move to the United States? It's because of the perception of opportunity, where, you know, in 99% of the rest of the world, the postal code you were born in or your last name, who mommy and daddy are, is actually much more deterministic of what your outcomes are going to be than it is in the United States. And so we self-scrutinize ourselves in the United States, saying, you know, where you're born determines where you end up. But that's actually less true than just about anywhere else in the world. So I really think I believe in the American dream. What is the American dream? Work hard, play by the rules, and you too will rise. You will be better off than the generation before you. And tying this to our previous conversation about sort of the emasculation that is felt in much of America, I think it's felt in part because of the perception rooted in economic reality that has sort of gotten frozen, that this constant upward economic and social mobility that takes place has gotten frozen. Juxtapose that with the Chinese, where they are taking these great leaps forward. And not just the Chinese, who have moved 800 million people out of poverty and into the middle class, but look at South Korea. You know, look at 10 to 12 other states that are still, maybe a little bit slowly, but the upward economic and social mobility are still apparent. But people around the world still believe that America is the land of opportunity. So the land of opportunity, I believe, needs to remain at the core of our narrative and at the core of our reality.
The last word on companies. I was fascinated when you brought this up in the book and need to do more reading on it myself, but can you talk about the socialists, because I just disparaged them a second ago, who are interested in the models of big companies like Walmart and Amazon and how that could actually inform how a we're not just looking back at 1960s America, socialism could look like, because that was just fascinating.
Yeah. So let me first say that I am anti-socialist. Like I don't believe in socialism. I should say that from the outset. And this is where I do squawk with people to the left of me quite frequently, because I believe we aren't ants. Human beings are governed by incentives. We want money. We want power. We want fame. We want sex. We want all of these things. And in a socialist society, unfortunately, what it does is it takes incentives out of the system, which is why they founder. Now, the idea, and this is something put forward by Cory Doctorow and others, is that communism failed, socialism failed because of a failure to efficiently allocate resources. So the idea in socialism or communism is essentially that, you know, we are going to equally distribute resources. But the Soviet Union and the socialist states of Eastern Europe failed in many respects because they underperformed market-based economies in the West that were more efficient about distributing resources. The theory now is that companies like Amazon and Walmart, which are themselves the sizes of nation states, have grown so sophisticated about resource allocation that if a country, you know, with the knowledge that we now have about supply chains, about resource allocation, were to integrate a, you know, Walmart grade model of resource allocation, then socialism or communism could work better. So it's really fascinating. You know, you think of the far left as being those who most believe that the Walmarts and the Amazons are, you know, the quintessentially evil. But what I find fascinating is this idea that they believe that they can draw knowledge from them about how to administer a socialist state. So I think it's really interesting as well. I'm glad you found that interesting.
Yeah. So in their mind, once again, there's only so much advocacy for ideas that aren't yours you could really push forward here. Mm-hmm. In their model, because this is the follow-up question people are probably wondering, is the logical conclusion that government should be more aggressive in encouraging, so accept the premise of these corporations, but take it to its logical conclusion, just be much more aggressive about mandating things? So it's saying, oh yeah, like we're just going to mandate that Amazon raise wages past $15, or mandate that actually Amazon offer this level of healthcare benefits and then distribute that. How does that just work logistically when they're thinking of this?
So the answer to your question is yes. Logistically, you know, if you think about organizations like Walmart and Amazon, they are command and control. They are deeply hierarchical. When you sort of turn the algorithmic knob, billions of dollars of resources flow. And so the idea essentially is yes, that, you know, to the extent that what you change are the inputs into the algorithms, then you get a differentiated set of outputs. You know, if you change the inputs that say, instead of hitting this quarterly target, which is going to produce a projected X or Y in terms of increased shareholder value, we're going to say make the minimum wage $19 an hour. We're going to say, you know, so the answer is yes, that with these very powerful machines, can become engines of economic policy and social policy. So if you wanted to do, if you wanted to do Medicare for all, for example, there's a good argument to be made that these very large institutions could, in effect, become the administrators or the payers for that kind of health policy. And part, we saw a little hint of this in the last 2 weeks. What's happened in the last 2 weeks? Both Walmart and Amazon have said that they will pay the college tuition costs for their hourly workers. Why did they do this? Well, they did this because of labor shortages. And the kind of employee they want is the kind of employee who's going to put their 40 hours in at the factory and then take classes and try to get that college degree. But it's fascinating. So for all of this, you know, Bernie Sanders' advocacy for free college, how interesting is it that you can, if you are an hourly worker at Amazon or Walmart, you are now eligible for free college? Fascinating contradiction.
So two big things I want to cover before we take this out. The first would be, let's go back to your invocation of the 19th century, because I've been increasingly interested in it, because a lot of the stuff is happening in Western Europe. So it's not exactly like in most of our historical memory, but it's also like not really covered at a K-12 and college level. So people aren't going to know who Benjamin Disraeli is. They're not going to think of the revolutions of 1848. All that being said, can you just expand around what you said of looking at how political leaders, whether they're using a Prussian German model in the late 19th century, or they are looking at coming to class-based consensuses in the United Kingdom during the 19th century as well, too, how should we learn from how their societies structured themselves and dealt with changes that on a personal level were obviously just as cataclysmic as ours were?
Yeah, so I do think understanding the 19th century is instructive. Why? Because the 19th century was the period where you essentially had to rewrite the social contract. You had to rewrite the social contract from one that was rooted in an agricultural-based economy to an industrial-based economy. So just let's rewind for a second. What was at the core of the agricultural-based social contract? What was at the core of that? Was the crown, the monarchs, would essentially give control, would, you know, give localized control to the elites, the dukes, the marchesi, the counts. They, in turn, would give the crown taxes and military service. Mm-hmm. The serfs were then obliged to live on the lands of their lord in exchange for a percentage of the crops, and, you know, they would get to use the land and they would get military protection. So this sort of equilibrium, this form of feudalism held for many, many hundreds of years. But then, and it really began happening in the 1790s and the first decade of the 19th century, you saw this acceleration of the move from countryside to city, from farm to factory. And for about 40 years, this period called the Engels Pause, named after Friedrich Engels, what we saw was this massive technology-driven change in the nature of work. But it was also the sort of industrialization of the Charles Dickens novels. It was 11-year-olds in factories losing fingers. It was, you know, 6 days away. It's the Upton Sinclair form of industrialization. What then happened? Well, as previously referenced, there were a wave of revolutions. There were ideological movements like communism. What ultimately made industrialization work? What ultimately made industrialization work was that leaders like Lord Asquith in the United Kingdom, Bismarck in Germany, inspired and working with, again, trying to draw some whole of society consensus. In the same way in which we were innovating technologically and scientifically, they innovated within their public policies. You know, they said, you know what, if you're going to work in our factory, you only need to work there 5 days a week instead of six. We're going to create this thing called a weekend. The weekend was actually an innovation of the 19th century. Before, the only day off was the day of our Lord, Sunday. We're going to set a 40-hour work week. And oh, by the way, there's going to be a minimum wage. The concept of the 40-hour work week and the minimum wage, 19th century. Free public education. You know, until you get to the age of 18, you can go to school for free. And then at age 18, the elites can go to university and the non-elites go to work in Fort Factory, mine, or mill. All of these were about sharing the benefits of the spoils of industrialization. And it was interesting to me to be see what you had was the state, the Bismarcks, the Lord Asquiths, working with industry, who in turn were working with citizens and civil society, you know, through labor organizations and other such things. And eventually, there was a sort of equilibrium. And it's, you know, it's the boundaries of this are tested and stretched, and you get the, you know, the antitrust movements that then take place in the United States in the early 20th century and what have you. But industrialization was made to work instead of having a perpetual state of revolution because of rewriting the social contract. Now we're transitioning from a dominantly industrial-based economy into one that is technology-rich and knowledge-based. But we're still relying on these same social welfare programs that are products of, you know, going on 200 years ago. We haven't rethought what a pension is since its origin. You know, we haven't rethought education. Education, the model of education exists right now in large part to accommodate allowing people to have summers off so that they could work on the farm. The age of 18 was actually for a reason. It was, okay, at age 18, these young people, the women are ready to have kids and the men are ready to go work in Port Factory, mine, or mill. We need to re-scrutinize a lot of the assumptions that went into the creation of these programs, which are still foundational in our social contract.
You know, we started by discussing our shared optimism, but this is where I get to my pessimism, because what was so important about your articulation of what we can learn from the 19th century is the roles that leaders were playing, successful leaders. It was, how do you form a consensus out of very fractious and oppositional factions in your society where, to a certain degree, this is a zero-sum game? A day off is another day not in the factory. Therefore, you have these oppositional sorts. And it doesn't feel like today we have a political class that conceives of itself around the consensus building role. So you have, and this is a super conventional wisdom take, but it's also true. You see every politician trying to find their own pet thing. You see them playing to their podcast audience. You see all these bits, and where I get frustrated is I get the sense that AOC understands that it's her job to promote the Green New Deal or to say tax the rich, but I don't think she has a conception of herself as a consensus builder, nor does she have particularly the skill set. And that's not her, this isn't a personal attack on her. You just see her as the most talented, once again, separate policy from politics, exemplar of the exact opposite style of politics from that 19th century model. So I'm just curious how you think about that part.
So I think this actually maps to some dynamics of the 18th century, where AOC is sort of an 1840s leader, right? So she is an example of a leader building the ferment, advocating for change, building the resistance. You know, resistance, you know, by its nature is non-governing. And so I think of whether it's left wing or right wing, I think of the ferment, the rage, you know, to come back to, you know, the title of my book, as being something that maps to the 1840s. And it was then after that period where you saw the emergence of the Bismarcks and the others who drew from that. But, you know, it wasn't like, you know, the anarchist labor leader who implemented these policies. You know, the anarchist labor leader may have advocated for X, and X minus 10 is actually what became codified into statute or regulation by leaders who do know how to forge consensus. One thing that I will say, Biden, the election of Biden interests me in this respect, because Biden is sort of the, you know, at least his background is sort of the classic deal-making, centrist, institutional Paul. So it does seem to me like America, I mean, when they elected a 77-year-old centrist, it did seem to me that the American people were saying, we would like somebody to actually sit at the head of the table and help us arrive at some solutions to this. Now, we'll see whether he's successful or not, but that does seem to be his instinct. And it does seem to me that that's what the American people elected. When you are electing, when you elect Joe Biden president, you aren't electing revolution. You are electing somebody who's going to try to drive some shared consensus.
Yeah, I think that's such a useful note, because I get frustrated when people, just by definition, lament Joe Biden's age as a problem. And it's so tragic that this was the choice, when what's useful about Joe Biden, once again, this is, as we talked about the Trump narrative versus the Trump policy, we're talking about the Biden narrative. It's like you said, the reason why Biden has that narrative is he emerged, and once again, he's been in the system for a while, during a different political era where those consensus voting skill sets were important. So that's something that I hope people could think about. And the last note I'll put on the 19th century point, and this is why it gets so interesting to your point about thinking of AOC as an 1840s politician, is that in many ways, the politicians that ended up forging the consensus that came out of that were not the ones you would expect based on the 1840s. So it's a Prussian militarist, Otto von Bismarck, who leads Germany to actually implement the basic foundations of the welfare state, not because he's an anarchist, not because he's a communist, but because his raw drive for power and nation and actual political ability meant that he actually had objectives. So it's just a suggestion that, as with the Walmart and Amazon example, as we're thinking about this 2020s period, we should think about how are these alliances and formations going to come in unconventional ways you wouldn't expect. So my last question here is a quick touch on the geopolitical bit, because it gets to a big debate that we're not going to settle here and is going to really undergird the next 20 or 30 years, which is this question of closed versus open, because this relates obviously to the US and Chinese models. And you can look at all the different factors that we're discussing today and come to some type of conclusion of what type of society is best fit to actually handle these questions, whether it's the Chinese open closed one or the American open one. I would just like to get a final word from you on how you think about that debate and why you're optimistic about the open system.
Sure. I mean, look, I think the principal political and economic binary of the 20th century was right versus left. I think the more instructive and realistic political binary of today is open versus closed. But let me define this a little bit. By open, I don't just mean the free flow of information. I don't just mean the free flow of information, human capital, and financial capital. It means upward economic and social mobility is not constrained to elites. It means that religious and cultural norms are not set by central authorities. It means that it is rights respecting across lines of gender, race, ethnicity, and sexuality. And so I want to be clear what I mean by open in this respect. And I do think that the states and societies that tilt toward openness are going to be those that are most, are going to be those that are best positioned to compete and succeed in the future. I think that China is unique. It has a fairly homogeneous population of 1.3 billion people with a 2,000-year history of command and control political systems, that's very, very difficult to export. And one thing that's interesting, unlike, say, the Soviet Union, China's really not trying to export its political or economic model. It's trying to maximize the benefit of its engagement around the world in service to, of its own interests. But it's not driven by ideology to try to flip the political systems elsewhere. Just my last point on this is that when I do think about the places that are competing and succeeding the best economically, let's just think about this in terms of economics. It oftentimes are those places that tilt toward openness. You know, whether it's European, even it's not a coincidence that in the Middle East, you know, Dubai has been sort of the area that has had the broadest level of prosperity. In the East Asian states that are more open, if you go to South Korea, if you go to Singapore, if you, you know, look at what's happening in Indonesia right now, those states and societies that are tilting toward openness as opposed to command and control, I think are the places where talent is gathering. It's where innovation is taking place and commercializing. And this might be a little utopian on my part, but it is what I believe.
Well, Alec, this has been really great. Would love for you to shout out the book and your previous book, Industries of the Future, that I referenced, and anything else listeners should check out.
Thank you. No, I greatly appreciate this. This book, The Raging 2020s, just published. And, you know, my prior work is The Industries of the Future. And so if you found this conversation interesting, we got deep. We go even deeper in The Raging 2020s. And, you know, I will say, just by way, you know, one of my tactics within this is in writing this book, some words that don't appear, Trump, Obama, Biden, none of those words appear, because I do think we need to elevate a little bit, in the same way in which in this podcast, you do a really good job of getting your listeners out of the sort of cable news mindset. You know, what happened this minute, and let's respond at 110 decibels, you know, with a bunch of catchphrases. You've done a great job of elevating and bringing real substance to issues that matter in our lives. And that's part of what I try to do with this book.
Awesome.
Raging 2020s. Thank you.
Dual endorsement. Alec, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.